A podcast of the cinema.
Your name is Alonzo Duralde. You are a film critic. You are the film reviews editor at therap.com. You are my husband. You are also the co-host of other podcasts like Maximum Film on the Maximum Fun Network, like Breakfast All Day on the YouTube, and sometimes on the Deck the Hallmark podcast when they deign to have you on beside them to guide them. You have co-written a book with them.
Yes.
Comes out in 25 minutes.
No, it's out next Tuesday.
Depending on when people listen to this podcast.
That's true. It could be in 25 minutes.
It might have been 2 months ago if that's also when you're listening to this podcast. It comes out on October 26th.
Correct.
The name of the book is I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies.
Yeah, and you have to say it exactly
you
like
better
that.
Say it just like
at
that.
At the bookstore, they won't
yeah.
get to you.
They listen. And then you give them a little God wink. That's what you're going to do. You waltz right into that bookstore.
Oh, have you been storing that one?
No, it just popped into my head. Listen, you think I'm walled off and don't know anything about what's going on in this blighted hellscape that you inhabit every chance you get. But I know, and I hear, and I see Candace Cameron Bure gallivanting around on that television, winking at people with her God eye. Or
she has not been in a God wink movie.
Oh, well, who's in
enough.
The God wink movie?
Kathy Lee Gifford was in the first two.
I see Kathy Lee Gifford frolicking.
And nobody wants to see that.
Least of all me. It's a bad thing. I mean, I'm glad you got a book deal out of it.
Thank you.
But how's your autograph hand, by the way?
Oh, it's fine right? now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you want a copy of the book that's signed by me and all three Deck the Hallmark guys, there's a company called Premier Collectibles that will send you one. And we all injured ourselves signing the book plates to go into these things.
You signed 2,000 of these book plates. Is that correct?
Give or take.
Yeah. You signed 2,000 book plates. You guys, this is a major publisher that's putting out this book. Hence, 2,000 book plates.
You're Dave White, by the way.
Not to brag that. About my husband and his autograph signing skills. But there's a need for the autograph when you've published a book with a major publishing house. I don't know what it's like to publish a book with a major publishing house.
It's a new one on me.
I wrote a stupid little book 15 years ago, or longer than 15 years ago, and it came out, and then it went away very quickly, and then it went out of print, and then the publisher went belly up, and,
yep.
And you know what? It's fine, because the book is not memorable, but it's
oh, fans come crawling out of the woodwork every so often.
Had you never... I... You know, been fancy, such as you at this moment. You know, I too would have received a box of author copies at the door. They just give them to you.
I have two goals for this book. Best case scenario is that it'll be the first thing I've ever written that one could just waltz into a Walmart or a Target and see on the shelf.
Yes.
Worst case scenario.
That is actually somewhat exciting to me.
I think it's very cool. Worst case scenario, this could be my first book to be remaindered, but I hope not.
I was in a, I, okay, you know what? I appeared in a major publisher's anthology in 2009.
Yes, you did.
Because and it's a wonderful anthology that I had nothing to do with other than contributing one essay, one story to. But Penguin put it out. And boy, it went remainder so fast. I just started buying copies for a buck a pop on the internet.
Anthologies are tricky.
Yeah.
But you got to go to New York City launch and everything.
New York City. The big time.
Yeah. Anyway, despite all of this, we're no one. But thank you for listening to our podcast.
Wait a second. You are very famous in this house at dinner time.
As the Spanish would say.
Did you say my name?
I did.
Say my name.
Dave White.
I'm also a film critic.
You are.
And my credentials
speak for themselves.
They end there. I'm a medium strength film critic.
You recently made at least one corner of Twitter abuzz over your Jesus Music review in the Wrap.
It was a little tiny corner.
Yes.
Of the Twitter. The tiniest little corner. Yeah, but, and you know why? Because that movie got about 10 reviews nationwide. Yeah. Like, no critic even gave it the time of day to review it.
I mean, like, there were no reviews for the fourth God's Not Dead movie, but that was like a two-night Fathom event, so I understand why no critics maybe ran out to see it. But the Jesus Music got, like, a real release. It was in theaters.
It is a theatrical release from Lionsgate in real movie theaters, and it just vanished like a ghost, and no one reviewed it, and I don't know anyone who went to see it. But I sure did write about it. We spent a whole hour talking about it.
We did. We had a very fun episode with our good friend Grace Baldridge, a.k.a. chart-topping. CCM artist Semler.
Okay, wait a second. There are now 12 reviews for the Jesus Music on Rotten Tomatoes. One of them is a fresh from Christy Lemire.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, good for her.
And it's right next to mine on the same
tier.
Yeah. Mine is not a fresh, juicy red tomato.
Yeah, it was a green splat.
Mine is a green splat. Someday, the identity of Director X will be revealed. He will have to die first of natural causes. After a lovely, lifelong life.
A well-fulfilled life.
Yeah. He's very nice.
Yes.
Very nice. We're not wishing for it.
No.
But we just can't tell you who it was.
Yes.
And if you don't know what we're talking about, it doesn't matter.
It's a long story.
It's an old-timey story from an old-timey podcast that's been on for too long.
Yeah, we are coming up.
Year 11.
Year 11.
Before the internet learned that podcasts were a thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about movies.
Let's.
We have three to discuss. And I want to jump right into, you think you want to hear about Halloween Kills first, but you don't. You want to hear about the Mia Hansen Love film. Is it Love?
I do not know.
It's that L-O-V-E last name.
But the O has
a line through it, and I don't know how you pronounce that kind of O.
I don't either.
And I haven't heard anyone pronounce her name the same way twice. And that's another problem for
me. Which means that none of us know how to do it.
Right. It's not like she's coming over to hang out and being like, Dave, you say my name this way.
Yes. You know. She's invited to come hang out.
If she wants to.
Sure.
She's not. Listen, she doesn't have that Olivier Assayas albatross around her neck anymore. she can come over anytime she wants. I don't know if he was an albatross or an anvil or
who knows.
He seems like an okay dude.
You never know about people's private lives.
We don't know. Mia Hansen Love has made a new film called Bergman Island.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just now for you and me, it is a really timely film because we recently finished watching all six episodes of the original Scenes from a Marriage on the Criterion Channel. And Ingmar Bergman shot Scenes from a Marriage. Some of it anyway.
Mostly, I think, except for some of the Stockholm exteriors.
On the Isle of Faro.
Faro.
Faro. Faro. Faro. F-A-R-O.
Yeah. But it's the A with the little circle on it.
Listen, in Sweden, everything is different with letters. So that was his, that was his refuge. That was his home, that island on the Baltic Sea. And he shot a lot of stuff there, including chunks of Scenes from a Marriage. So Mia Hansen-Love goes to Oro, and she makes this movie called Bergman Island. It stars Vicky Krieps?
I think it's Krieps.
I want her last name to be pronounced Cripes.
Like Cripes, comma Vicky.
Vicky Cripes. The most famous person from Luxembourg.
Yes.
Yeah. Stars her and Tim Roth. It also stars Mia. I'm going to say her last name badly too, because I can't say anyone's name properly on this episode. Wasikowska.
I think it's Wasikowska.
Is it?
I think it's at least Wasikowska.
When did that group meeting happen where we all learned how to say it?
Well, that's why there was that running joke in.
Is this about me being in a bubble of my own?
Maybe. In the J.J. Abrams Star Trek,
To say people's names right.
There's the whole running gag about Anton Yelkin's Chekhov getting V and W sounds mixed up.
All right.
The Polish W is V. That's why it's Wawenza and not, or Walenza and not, whatever.
It also stars Anders Danielsson Lee.
Yes.
And if you don't know who he is, it's maybe because you haven't seen enough Joachim Trier films.
Yes.
Because he's in most of the films from Joachim Trier. Reprise, Oslo, August 31st. And so he's a Norwegian actor who's really cool.
Yeah.
All right. Now, this movie. It is set at the Bergman compound, which is a cinephile tourist destination. I did not know this.
Yeah,
me neither. It is a real thing. Like once a year, they have a Comic-Con.
like a
Bergman Con.
a conclave of sorts.
And you can go and you can get a little tour bus and go on the safari and you can, visit the house. There's a little museum. There's a library.
They have, grants for young filmmakers, I think, to go out there and work on scripts.
This is all real.
Or whatever. So Krieps and Roth play a married couple with a child who is not with them. They are both filmmakers. He is apparently sort of a Hollywood hotshot type, and she is more, indie art house. Personal relationship movies.
He might be a little bit Olivier size.
Maybe.
Me might be.
Maybe.
She might be a little Mia Hansen-Love.
Maybe. He's there giving lectures and screening films, and she's there to work. And they are at, is it actual Bergman's house that they're in?
Yeah.
Because they talk about how, oh, yes, he shot part of Scenes from a Marriage in the bedroom. And she's well, that's not good.
They're in the Scenes from a Marriage bedroom.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is, and as, of course, the tour guide, it's like, as you know, it caused millions of divorces. By the way, this is a comedic drama.
Yes.
There's a lot that is funny going on in this film.
And I want to say just up front, you can go into this movie having never seen an Ingmar Bergman movie and having no thoughts about Bergman, pro or con, or the details of his work, and anything you need to know, the movie tells you. If you do come in armed with some knowledge of Bergman and his work, your
experience will be enhanced.
Yes,
you'll be that person going, "Ooh,
I shudder to call them Easter eggs in this case, but definitely there's.
Why not?
There's some treats along
Marvel,
the way.
Should Marvel people have all the Easter eggs? Why can't art house people have Easter eggs too? Let's just say that's what they are.
Okay, fine.
All right.
They're Easter eggs.
The The story is this. They are a couple who are not necessarily unhappy. Unlike almost everyone in every other Bergman film.
Yes.
Okay. They are not necessarily unhappy. However, you know, they don't always communicate well. Things sometimes go unsaid between them. Sometimes there's a little bit of passive aggressiveness going on.
Mm-hmm.
But they seem to be functioning fairly normally. Like they enjoy each other.
Yeah.
You know, they're not there to, you know, hash it out. They're not there to listen. If you've seen the OG Scenes from a Marriage, or any Ingmar Bergman film where people are married, there is an existential crisis going on almost all the time. And that isn't really on the front burner with these two.
No, it's a mostly functional relationship,
yeah.
I would say.
But, you know, maybe it's the pull of the place. Maybe it's the location. Maybe it's the fact that they are both involved in their own creative endeavors where they are imagining other possibilities, not just for their characters, but for themselves.
Right.
That stuff starts to happen. And people start to pop up. People who could, you know, put a rock in the shoe of this relationship. Some of those people wind up inside the movie that is within the movie.
Yes. About midway through, Vicky Creeps begins to relate to Tim Roth. I don't remember any of the character names. Her screenplay idea. She, you know, and she basically begins to tell him the story of it. And as she does, we see it as a movie. And that movie features Mia Wasikowska and Anders...
Danielson Lee
as a couple who had broken up years earlier, both winding up on photo for a friend's wedding and reconnecting, and what do they do and what decisions do they make, and then yeah, an actual person that she has encountered during their trip pops up as a character within this film, leading us to understand that he is weighing more heavily on her mind than
exactly.
She might have otherwise indicated.
I did a little homework. There is a Mia Hansen Love film that I have not seen, but it's called Goodbye First Love.
Okay.
Which is about adolescent, teenage boyfriend, girlfriend, who they move from that adolescence into adulthood. And it would seem to me that there are echoes of that in this. Like I said, I haven't seen it, but knowing what the plot is of that first film, there are sort of references, I think, happening. I want to go back and watch this first film from her now to find out just how much it mirrors what's going on.
It's not her first film, because her first film is called All Is Forgiven, and that's actually opening at the Metrograph for the first, it's getting its first U.S. release.
Okay.
It's opening at the Metrograph on November 5th, and then I think expanding after that. But yeah, I love this, and I love Things to Come.
Yeah.
So I want to go back and get caught up with this filmmaker, because I think she's awesome.
So what you have here in this story within a story, movie within a movie, is obviously a lot of references to Ingmar Bergman. But kind of Vicky Creeps' character says this early in the film, you know, what would Bergman's career have been like had he, also had to be home and being domestic?
Right.
Because he was fully focused on his career. He had many children with many different women, and by all accounts, was fully focused on his career during this time. And she states, her character states in the beginning of the film, well, he would have never gotten away with that if he were a woman.
Right.
And so this film, to me, feels like what perhaps a more domestically minded, you know, keep it together kind of person Bergman, the kind of film he might have made.
Oh, interesting.
Where people do roll with the punches and look for resolutions and look for compromises and look for ways to balance their lives together. Because, again, you don't see her and Roth's characters coming to any sort of explosive...
No.
You know...
They're not at loggerheads or
anything. Epiphany about anything. They are just going to keep working it out.
Yeah. I think that...
Everything doesn't have to be a meltdown. You know?
It was interesting the way she looks at the process. And again, this is something that comes up in things to come. I think she makes these really interesting movies about how writers write and why writers write.
Yeah.
And you get the impression that there is some road not taken exploration. There is some conversations that are going the way I would have liked them to have gone that are coming out in this screenplay that are part of how she and Tim Roth keep it together.
Yeah.
They have this outlet of their work where they can, you know, it's almost like, it's not that they're cheating on each other, but that they're certainly doing stuff in their own writing and their own art that they don't have to deal with each other. And it can, lets the relationship run more smoothly.
I think that's the secret to any relationship, honestly. Like,
you don't say it to them, but you say it to somebody, you know?
Pandemic notwithstanding, and the fact that you and I have been in the same apartment for, you know, well over a year and a half together.
Yeah.
And not going too many places.
New.
You know, you and I, and also this podcast notwithstanding, and all the others that we do together, where we work together frequently, day in, day out, we still are separate people.
Yeah.
You know, we have our own things that we go off and do that don't involve the other one at all. You know, interests, things we like to do, stuff we enjoy, that the other one is like, you know what? Have fun. Go have fun. And I think that if we didn't have the same job that kept us together a lot, you know, in the same projects,
sure,
we would be probably even, you know, more separate entities. Mm-hmm. You know? What I love about this, I want to go back to how this film is constructed and the way that identity doesn't shift, but you see doubling up going on.
Yeah.
And that's a Bergman thing.
Totally.
For sure. And I like those, you know, allusions to his work and how, you know, she is taking on some of his formal elements and yet making them into a whole other shape that emotionally feels much less fraught and much less, you know, apocalyptic.
Right. God's silence.
Right. So I'm very much in favor of this film. I think it's deceptively simple.
Yes.
It's charming. You really enjoy being with everybody in the film.
You want to go there.
Oh, man. Yeah.
It's just between the natural beauty of the place and all these lovely little cabins and, you know, you want to go to the screening room and have somebody, you know, run the Hour of the Wolf for you or something, you know.
Yeah. You know, maybe someday we'll go to Foro after I learn how to pronounce anyone's name and words that I need to say.
We'll get you some flashcards.
Embarrass myself. Oh, here comes that big, dumb, fat American who can't say anything the right way. He's a treat. Bergman Island.
Yeah.
Please get a chance to look at it soon.
It's currently only in theaters, but, you know.
It is right now in theaters.
It will be streaming soon enough.
Yeah. Halloween. Halloween. Halloween Kills.
So it does. Do we want to do our advertisement first?
You know what? We ought to should.
Yes.
Because it's that time of the show when we normally do our ad.
I'll tell you what doesn't kill: buying some nice furniture. The worst segue ever.
All right. Ad three for RogerandChris.com.
Mm-hmm.
RogerandChris.com.
RogerandChris.
They are a furniture company. They make custom furniture. And I think that word freaks people out.
Yeah.
Because what they immediately think is, oh, no. That's like, you know, I'm going to Savile Row to have a bespoke suit made for myself. And it's...
And then it's off to the haberdasher.
It's not like that. No. Because what you get when you go to their site is like a million options.
Yes.
So it's not exactly what you're thinking of when you think of a custom build. You get to select all the different parts.
Yes.
But it's not like you can just, you know, give them a drawing and say...
You can't be Frank Gehry and crumple up a wad of paper.
make this into a building. Exactly. In that context, however, you have thousands of choices.
Yes.
All right, here are the talking points. Custom-built furniture to your size, your depth, even the height that you prefer. Over 1,000 colors and tons of options for customization, like down-free. Unlike the vast majority of furniture brands, they actually build their own furniture in their own factories in Hickory and Davidson, North Carolina. They put that same furniture that you order for your home into businesses around the world. This is a strong enough for Starbucks, but made for your living room situation.
Nice.
Do you have any butts on a chair in Starbucks?
So many butts.
And fat butts like mine.
Well, yeah.
I'm a chair-breaking man. I've broken, how many chairs have I broken in my life? At least two.
Starbucks will serve you a venti frappuccino, so there are some butts in there.
Anyway.
That will punish furniture.
You ever see a chair break at Starbucks? Doesn't happen.
Nope.
Yeah. So, Roger and Chris's furniture does not break.
No.
I also know this for a fact because we own one of their chairs.
Mm-hmm.
This is why we're so happy to do this ad
for sure
for them. Aside from the fact that they're also paying us to do this ad.
I mean, yes.
But if I were just like, you know, if some strange furniture company came to us and said, hello, advertise for us. My first question, honestly, for them would be, would my chair that I bought from you be destroyed soon? Like within
by my fatness.
Within 3 years. Would it? I want to know the answer to that. And I want someone who will honestly say to me, yes. Remember that guy in West Elm?
Mm-hmm.
He looked at us. He goes, 3 years. And we were like, thank you. Thank you so much. He was a gay.
Yeah.
Like us. We were like, thank you, gay.
Thank you, secret handshake.
Yeah.
But Roger and Chris stuff.
We want a chair from Roger and Chris.
Goes the distance.
It is big. It is comfy. It is sturdy. We are fat. We both love sitting in this chair when it's reading time.
I had a moment in my adulthood where an older, wiser person took me aside and said, instead of buying all these crappy structure clothes, you need to spend a little more money on a nice suit.
Yeah.
And that suit lasted me a very long time. In fact, if I weren't such a fatto, that suit would probably still be working because it was in great shape. I outgrew it, unfortunately. But there comes a moment where you have to just sort of like decide, instead of getting the flimsy furniture, you know, on the cheap, I'm going to spend a little more for something that's going to last.
Mm-hmm.
And Roger and Chris is there for you when you reach that moment.
RogerandChris.com. Shop. End of ad. Halloween kills.
Yeah, I guess it does.
Would you like for me to tell everybody what happens?
You just watched it, so sure.
In the film Halloween Kills.
And you can pronounce all the names this time, I think.
Jamie Lee Curtis. Judy Gruyere.
Stop.
All right. This one picks up right after the last one. The one that David Gordon Green made.
2018.
The one where Jamie Lee Curtis has booby-trapped her extreme doomsday prepper murder house for the sole purpose of trapping and killing Michael Myers should he ever come after her again. But she's ready for it. She spent her whole life doing nothing except raising Judy Greer and preparing for disaster, which is kind of a bummer. You want Laurie Strode to have had a better life.
Yes, especially because in this version, they're pretending that nothing after the first Halloween happened.
Right.
So we're picking up 40 years later, no Halloween water,
no Tyra Banks Halloween.
Witness protection, no Tyra Banks, no Cult of Thorn, none of that. Just bam, right? Yep. 40 years later, murder house, she's ready to go.
Yeah. So
I did not care for the 2018 version.
Well, hang on now.
Okay, sorry.
At the end of the 2018 film, you know, she's got him in the house. It's on fire.
Mm-hmm.
But what did she not do? She did not chop off the head. Everybody knows you got to chop off the head.
She also did not have a contingency.
And also take the head with you and put it in a wood chipper. That way.
For double plus.
That way it won't like fuse back together because he is supernatural.
Yeah.
He is a supernatural.
It won't grow a new body out of the neck.
Yeah. You need to figure it out. You need to make sure that you have annihilated that physical situation.
Also, for all of her contingencies of like, I'm going to set this house to burn up with him in it, she did not have a contingency set up of like, oh, and I'm going to tell the fire department not to come.
Right.
Because as she is being taken away in an ambulance, the fire trucks are headed towards her house.
Here we go to put out the fire.
No.
Here we go to be killed by Michael Myers.
Yes.
Yeah, so there you go.
Boy, does he.
I just made up that song.
You did.
Just now.
Sometimes.
So here we are in this new film. Where it's
that very night. It's November 1st, I think.
It is still that very night. And lots of people in the town have no idea what's going on. They don't know that he's back. They don't know that he's out already murdering people. They don't know. So a lot of them have gathered in a bar to commemorate the 40-year anniversary of, or the 40-whatever-th year, anniversary
if it's still 2018, it's 40 years.
Oh, you're right, it is. Yeah. To commemorate the 40th anniversary of all the murders. And some of the people in the bar are people who were there for that moment. Like, I'm the kid that Laurie Strode was babysitting, played by Anthony Michael Hall. I'm the kid that whose sister was killed, you know, played, I don't know who plays her.
Well, Kyle Richards, right?
Oh, that's right. It is Kyle Richards.
Yes,
that's
returning for 40 years.
Kyle Richards. And speaking of Easter eggs, a Real Housewife.
Yes.
She's back.
The woman who plays Loomis's nurse, who dies in Halloween 2?
Part 2, yeah.
But because Halloween 2 no longer counts, she's back in this one, too.
Yeah. A vigilante mob forms when they find out that he is back. The vigilante mob is led by Anthony Michael Hall and all the bar people. And eventually it becomes like the town. Like anyone who's within earshot of the chanting mob.
Yeah.
carrying like... they might as well be carrying tiki torches. They're not. But like we'll get to that in a minute.
This should have been an opera.
Mm-hmm.
When that mob was like going through the halls of the hospital, it's like there should be a number here.
Yeah.
Some big Les Mis like, no, tonight, evil dies tonight.
Identities are confused. There are people who are just lying in wait. Or rather, they're not lying in wait. That's the wrong thing to say. They are just at their homes doing their home things.
Yes.
And Michael Myers comes to their homes and kills them. One of the couples being killed is an older man and woman who don't seem to have any connection to anything other than they just exist to be killed.
Yeah.
The other couple that is going to be, you know, attacked by Michael Myers is a gay couple who have bought the old murder house and renovated it, you know, the way the gays do.
Yeah, who else is going to gentrify the Myers house?
One of the gays is played by one of the guys from the Righteous Gemstones, which makes sense because
he is part of the
David Gordon Green universe.
And in the movie is co-written by Green and
Danny McBride. And the other guy is played by Michael McDonald.
Of Mad TV.
Not the Doobie Brothers Michael McDonald, but the Mad TV Michael McDonald, who you just told me, fun fact, has now been killed in films by Michael Myers and Mike Myers.
Yes, he's the guy who gets run over by a steamroller slowly in Austin Powers.
Yeah. So, tell me what you thought, because you and I think, are going to be approaching this maybe a little different.
Yeah, and I think we had differing viewpoints on the last David Gordon Green go-round with this as well. I don't think these movies are interesting or are adding anything to the mythos. And this one, I think, is quite messy in terms of the fact of, like, what's it even trying to say about mobs, let's say, or generational trauma, or... Yeah. I don't even know, but it seems to be floating out these ideas that it then has no idea what to do with. It's like, are they saying that mob violence is bad? Well, I mean, kind of, but at the same time, they're also arguing that mobs can be sure effective when you're trying to track down a vicious serial killer. But then on the other hand, they don't really accomplish anything. Or maybe if the idea that Michael Myers, as has been long established over the various different... versions, you know, whether you're following the OG, you know, 1 through 6, whether you're following the resurrection timeline, you're following the Rob Zombie timeline, or now the David Gordon Green one, like, Michael Myers is this indestructible, unstoppable, you know, murder machine.
Yes.
So where are the stakes? You know, like, there is no Achilles heel to this character. There's no personality to this character, really.
Correct.
Except that he's like a 6-year-old boy, but with the strength of 10 men, you know?
Right.
I just didn't care. Like, nothing felt like it was adding up to anything. The kills, as if we're to take the title as being a noun instead of a verb, weren't super interesting. It just all felt very kind of muddled. And I mean, like, my favorite part is when they think that Michael Myers is dead, and then Laurie Strode's granddaughter finds out that he isn't, and her response is, "What?"
A new generation of people not understanding that he cannot be killed.
Yeah, I wasn't scared. I wasn't interested. I don't think this thing works.
In 1978, when I was 14, and I went to see Halloween in a movie theater.
An unassailable classic.
The first week it opened, before anyone had told me anything.
Mm-hmm.
Scared out of my mind.
Sure.
Never seen a movie like that before, because I had not yet seen Texas Chainsaw Massacre, because I was much too young to see Texas Chainsaw Massacre when it came out. But there was no home video yet.
But to be clear, unlike Owen Gleiberman, you do not think that Halloween is merely a ripoff of Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Of course not. Yeah. No.
Okay.
But it was about a serial killer that runs around.
Yes.
You know, serial killing.
Yes. In a mask.
In a mask. Right. No, what did Owen Gleiberman say about
it? Oh, he basically says that Halloween is just sort of a knockoff of Texas Chainsaw.
Oh, did he say that?
Oh, yeah. Film Twitter, as you might imagine, had its own thoughts.
Oh, well. Okay. No, that's not what I mean.
Yes.
There was a mask.
Wanted to be clear.
There was a mask and there was killings. Yes. Yeah, that's fine. All right. Don't yell at me.
Don't at him.
No, number one rule of this show, don't yell at me. I remember when Halloween 2 came out, and I went to see it and thought, that was good. I was no longer afraid of Michael Myers. When Halloween 2 came out, I was no longer afraid of Michael Myers, right? The ensuing 40 years have only succeeded to make me look at him like, oh, yeah, Michael Myers.
Are we still doing that? That's
yeah,
cute.
Yeah, Michael Myers. Well, there he is. Has he got the mask on? Okay, good, good, good. Because he needs to have the mask on.
Yeah. Can we get a picture?
Yeah, exactly. Hey, it's my old buddy, Michael Myers. You been stabbing anybody lately? Good, good. Good job.
Big fan. Keep up
the good. Yes. I can only imagine that that means if you are a filmmaker trying to breathe life into this story somehow, do you think you're going to make him scary again? You're not going to make him scary again. There's nothing scary about this character anymore. These are not horror films in the sense that they are scaring you. These are stories now about a very famous person that you know a lot about.
Right.
In fact, you know everything there is to know about him. There are no secrets to Michael Myers anymore because every bit of information we've ever been given about him, we know it. And there isn't a lot. It's well, just a, you know.
And again, you have to, it's which of the Halloween timelines you're talking about? Because on some, in the original Halloween 2, they established that Laurie Strode is his sister.
Yes.
And apparently there was a cut moment from the first one where like he writes sister on the blackboard in the
right.
school or something.
Yeah.
But then in subsequent versions, they take that out. So we do know everything we need to know, but we need to know which universe we're
in. I could have sworn that there was a sequel down the road where they reestablished that she's his sister. And
maybe,
it kind of goes back and forth.
I'm not an expert on it.
But again, at this point in history, none of this matters.
Right.
What matters is, what kind of movie are you going to make with this character? What are you going to make James Bond do in James Bond Kills?
Right.
So, because of that, I'm kind of into this version. I'm kind of into this movie. Going back to Bergman Island, this is Easter eggs. You know. There's a slat covered closet.
Sure, yeah.
Hey, look at that closet. It's got slats on it.
You remember
that? Remember that slat covered closet? You know, when I see that, I think, okay, yeah, I got
the kids in the park are wearing the masks from Halloween 3. I get it.
That's fun, yeah. You know, you've got it's set in a hospital for the most part.
Yes, like the last two Halloween 2s.
Yeah. You know, you've got people understanding that, you know, he always returns home. And that's, you know, that was the tagline of the first film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all the stuff that you remember as part of the lore of this character, it's here. So that's comforting on that level. That makes it a cozy movie, right?
Sure. But,
I'm telling you, listen. All right. My Halloween experience is valid, so
I poured myself a cup of tea and wrapped up in an afghan to watch a Halloween kill.
Yeah,
all right, fine.
There are those of us
okay.
who feel these ways about these, you know, films and these characters. I also think that there's some fun, humorous stuff going on here. It's perverse humor, but it's humor nonetheless. Like when he kills the first couple, the first thing you hear is applause, which then bleeds into the bar scene of people applauding an act that's on stage. But while you're still in the house watching these people bleed out, the applause begins. And I've always, you know, been the person in the horror movie who, when the kill happens, is like, yeah, get him. Because you're on the side of Jason and Freddy and Michael Myers and Leatherface. They're your dudes now. When a new horror movie comes along and introduces a new terrifying thing, you are identifying with the people who are trying to escape. You know, when I saw The Strangers, I was like, Liv Tyler, please get out of the house, right?
You identify with Clarice and not with Hannibal.
Right. But once the killer becomes the star,
yeah,
they're
it's Hannibal's show.
They're your buddy, and you are like, who are you going to stab? Hope you stab him good. And he does some good stabbing in this movie. Yeah. There's some pretty nice stabbing in this movie. Lots of cool impalings. A lot of people get it in the neck, which is wonderful. You know, you get to see them just be like shoved down onto spikes and poles and stairways and stuff. For those of us who enjoy watching a good horror movie kill, there's some pretty good stabbings.
Yeah.
I'm into it.
For me, one of the few things that the previous Halloween had going for it was doomsday prepper Laurie Strode.
Yes.
Like, you know, like unhinged grandma, don't go near her house, like, you know.
Right, right.
Singularly focused Laurie Strode.
Yeah.
Who spends most of this movie in a hospital bed doing nothing.
Doing nothing. Yeah, this movie is barely about her.
Yeah. And it's like, why are we even here?
Because
here's we're not what, because Michael's not that interesting.
Here's why I think we're here. The reason we are here, and this is after the Easter eggs and after the stabbings, mm-hmm. here's why I think we are here.
Okay.
I think we are here because this is a film about Donald Trump. And I don't know if it was an intentionally designed film about Donald Trump, but it is a film. For me, this is a film about Donald Trump and the chaos that he didn't build himself, but he sure did pour gasoline on stuff and light a match. And so what you then have in this film is a movie about everybody else other than Laurie Strode. Everybody else in the town who have been, in the words of the film, infected by the fear and the panic and the anger and the grief that life in that small town has given them since those murders. And what do? They form a mob. And who do they chase? The wrong person. And where do they do it? In a hospital full of signs, by the way, that say, vaccinate before it's too late. Did you notice those?
I did not. No.
Yes.
There's a horse in the hospital.
And there's not just a horse in this hospital. There's a stampede of horses in this hospital because by the time the movie is about halfway through, you can't get through the halls of the hospital because this town-sized mob of people have decided to overrun the hospital and go on a yakety-sacks chase through the place, chasing the wrong guy because someone says something. And someone says, wait, did you say that look like Michael? It's Michael! Let's get him! He's not wearing his mask. Well, then how do we know what's true? Let's get him anyway.
Right, but then by the end... Okay, go ahead.
And they pursue their garbage agenda throughout the night. It is no mistake, I think, that these characters are doing this stuff. And they're doing it in all the wrong places for all the wrong reasons. And they have become irrational in their pursuit of this killer. And when they finally get to him, I won't give away any spoilers, but you know what happens to dumb people when they F around?
They find out.
So I think that's what this movie's about. And that, on top of the Easter eggs, on top of the good stabbings, means I'm kind of into it.
See, here's the thing. I think there's an idea of let's make a movie about, you know, mob mentality and about, sure, even Trump's America, let's say.
Yeah.
But the movie keeps vacillating back and forth as to what they mean by that, what they think about that, whether right. they think it's a good idea or a bad idea, whether I think it's an effective way to do things or an ineffective one.
Yes.
And so I was left with this thought of like, well, there's an intent to have an idea here, but I don't know what any of the ideas are.
I think the ideas are to reflect back to the audience the country that we live in now.
I think you're being real generous, but
I don't think David Gordon Green is a dummy.
I don't think he's a dummy, but I think he's a very erratic filmmaker.
Oh, okay, yes, he is a very erratic filmmaker. But I also think that this exists. I think this film exists for a reason. And I think that's the reason.
I think it's shooting for something and it doesn't get anywhere close to any of it.
It might not be fully successful. It might not have an answer.
No, I don't know. I'm not wanting an answer. I just want a coherent, point of view,
Okay, well, I think it's a film about chaos.
Okay.
And therefore, it's pretty messy and chaotic. Can I just say, the gays.
Oh, yay.
The gays in this movie are, first of all.
Why are you watching Minnie and Moskowitz on Halloween night?
Why not? Why not watch Minnie and Moskowitz on Halloween night? Eating some, a crudité platter, And dressed up in costumes, although you have no intention of going anywhere?
Well, yeah, one's a pirate, and the other one is.
Well, that's what gays do.
They
love a costume. I'm concerned more about their furnishings, their choice of furnishings, because they have a whole collection of some kind of vintagey grandma plates in their bedroom. And that didn't make any sense to me. It's in a lighted hutch in a corner, and I'm like, girl,
if you are Haddonfield's leading interior decorator, that's a pretty low bar to clear.
I think it's weird also that, and I know it's meant to be a private couple joke that, they have the same name.
Yes.
So the tall one calls the shorter one Big John, and the shorter one calls the tall one Little John.
Yes.
And that's an adorable little couple thing to do. We know. How many gay male couples do we know who have the same name? At least one, right? Isn't there more than one that we
know? At least one that I know. And
we know the Bens.
And the Calebs.
And the who are the, wait, the Calebs.
I know the Calebs.
You know the Calebs. Yeah. I know the Bens.
And I know we both know the Bens.
So
Christy and Lemire and her husband Chris.
That's different.
Okay.
That's different. Straight people, you don't get to have this fun. It doesn't matter. So, the gays are ridiculous in this film,
yeah, I know.
And yet I was fully into their.
Well, it's not like everybody else was such a vividly drawn character.
Also, I do have a logistical question, but it's a spoiler.
Oh.
So I will only say it in this one way.
Okay.
Who put the Anne Murray record on the turntable? Watch the movie. And when you get to the part where the Anne Murray record is on the turntable, you'll understand why I am asking who put the Anne Murray record on the turntable.
I will say this, and I, not to get into this.
Because that's a level of is it homophobic irony?
It's a little on the nose, perhaps.
Yeah.
I will say, my thing with this, I think the first Halloween, again, great, great, classic, iconic, important movie.
Yeah.
I don't really care about any of the follow-ups. Even Halloween 3, fun idea, not in love with the execution. But I feel like these movies are like Michael in that they obsessively return to the same stuff over and over again.
Yeah.
And, and the results don't ever differ. And I don't know, I'm just... I wish we could just I know David Gordon Green has one more of these coming, and I would just like Michael to go on the shelf for a while, because I don't think anybody has anything interesting to do with him at this point. We're just repeating ourselves and occasionally trying to come up with some interesting kills, which you found more interesting than I did.
I didn't say they were interesting. I just said they were fun to watch.
Fine.
I love a kill.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a new Todd Haynes film.
Mm-hmm.
It is a documentary called The Velvet Underground. And it is perfect. It is perfect. A few weeks ago, I was kind of moping around the apartment, you know, thinking about everything sucking. And then I started thinking, and movies are sucking right now too. What's going on? How come I haven't been excited? How come I haven't been thrilled lately? What's, is it my fault? Am I just,
the beginning
am
of
I
the
broken inside?
I think September, we've commented in the past, is the January of the fall.
Yes.
It is, you know, it's like right after the fall festivals, there's a couple of movies that like at some point down the line thought, oh, we're going to be Oscar contenders. And right. then at some point later down the line, they realize, no, we are not. But we're going to come out in September and pretend like we're a prestige fall movie.
Right.
And then we'll be gone and forgotten by the time right. the actual prestige fall movies come out.
So this is Todd Haynes' documentary about the band The Velvet Underground.
Yes.
Lou Reed, John Cale, Mo Tucker, Sterling Morrison. They were the Velvet Underground. They formed in New York in the mid-1960s. And they were particularly Reed and Cale. They were like the bummer Lennon and McCartney in that they had distinct sensibilities that somehow worked together perfectly.
Yes.
Even though they might have seemed at odds with each other. They started playing around town. Andy Warhol found them. Boom. They were part of the factory. They were part of a scene. Andy Warhol came in to, I'm putting air quotes around this word, produce their first album, which, when you think about it, he really did produce their album because he kept
the label.
He kept Know Nothing people at the record label at bay because they were afraid of him, I think. And he would just say, you know, I imagine him standing in the studio and them playing a song and him going,
it's great.
It's great. That's great. Love it.
Fun.
Yeah. And everyone else, all the engineers being like, okay.
All right. Yep. Sure. Whatever you say, boss.
And so I, you know, I'm a huge fan of Velvet Underground. I've been since I was a young person, which was a long time ago. And when I found out that Todd Haynes was the man making this film, I thought, oh, good. Like, if anyone's going to make a Velvet Underground documentary, let it be Todd Haynes. Because he will take the material and make it something that is art all by itself. You not only will you learn about this band, but you'll learn about the stuff that shaped this band. And the film itself sort of embodies the stuff that shaped this band.
Yes, it reflects their aesthetic.
He lays a groundwork at the beginning of the film of, you know, strands of American culture that were pulling together and coming apart at the same time. There's a clip of not only John Cale on a game show called I've Got a Secret, hosted by
Gary Moore.
Why do I never remember his name?
I don't know.
I've seen so many episodes of I've Got a Secret, and I can never remember Gary Moore's name.
He also hosted the second iteration of To Tell the Truth.
Yeah. So you're John Cale on a game show called I've Got a Secret, where a panel of, you know, notable people. I wouldn't say celebrities, but they were, you know, like Bennett Cerf and...
No, Betsy Palmer, going back to Friday the 13th.
Betsy Palmer and...
Harry Morgan, yeah. Bill Cullen, and the Miss America.
Which one?
Bess Meyerson.
Okay. I was thinking of What's My Line, right?
Bennett Cerf was What's My Line.
Along with Dorothy Kilgallen.
Yes, and Arlene Francis.
Arlene Francis, right. Yes. Kitty Carlisle. Yeah. Did you not recognize any of the names that we just
start watching Buzzer?
Start watching Buzzer. You might not recognize names in this film either, but the you should learn all of them. Anyway, you see a clip of John Cale on I've Got a Secret, and then you see an earlier clip of John Cage, experimental
composer,
monumentally important composer of the mid-20th century. John Cage on I've Got a Secret, performing one of his pieces, which is just like, you know, noises.
It involves a piano and a bathtub.
And the audience laughing.
Yes.
And that laughter, never underestimate the power of yahoos laughing at you to make you go out and create your art.
Yeah,
that John Cage needed that, because he was already doing whatever he wanted anyway. But people who were young at that time, people who were young at that time, Lou Reed, John Cale, who were like, we're not like the rest of you, and we're going to do something that you haven't heard quite yet. They took the influence of people like Cage. They took the influence of musicians like Lamont Young and Tony Conrad, who were building sort of drone compositions. And then they put pop music on top of it.
In the past, when we've talked about the King family as being, you know, the culture that the counterculture was countering.
Yes.
You know, these guys are coming out of like the 50s and early 60s, a very buttoned down, conformist post-World War II America.
Right.
And so there is this legit thing to respond to. You know, so they're also kind of following the Beats and, you know, Allen Ginsberg and you know, the Grove Press writers. You know, you could even trace this to like the Dadaists of the 20s or whatever. But at the same time, they are grafting it with a pop sensibility. They are a band and they are putting out records. They aren't just like having these installation happenings. They're actually, you know, part of the scene.
We're making a record for you to buy.
Yeah.
And maybe get played on the radio. It didn't get played on the radio. So Todd Haynes takes all of this stuff and first person accounts from as many people as possible. Some who are still alive, some in archival footage. But every single person that you hear from or see on camera was directly connected to someone in the band or to the band itself. So a friend of mine said, I'm just glad, in spite of how much I like Henry Rollins and Thurston Moore, I'm glad they weren't in it.
Yeah.
We didn't need cultural commentators coming in and talking about them from a remove, even if that band directly influenced their band.
Right.
And the Velvet Underground influenced everybody that came after in the world of punk and unusual music.
Yeah.
Okay.
You know, they talk a lot to Jonas Mekas, but, you know, he, as a filmmaker, his films were part of, like, their live performances.
Yes.
And he's also part of that whole kind of Warhol mid-60s avant-garde explosion. So he's both a first-person witness and an adjunct, in a way, to the band itself.
Yeah. The kind of thing where everyone was sort of influencing each other. Everyone was in the same fish tank.
Yeah.
Not necessarily doing the same thing, but building a world. And the world they built was often mistaken as sort of, you know, well, this is like the hippies.
Yeah.
But they were not hippies.
No. The hippies hated them.
The hippies hated them and they hated the hippies. Yes. Mary Warnoff. It's so funny. She's like, so we all go to Los Angeles. And everybody there was so healthy.
Just them sitting around the pool wearing black.
You know? Dripping disdain. And they're all like sunglasses, wearing black clothes, being photographed by a pool.
Mo Tucker's like, ugh, the peace and love people. We were not that. It's like when you hear John Waters talk about hippies. It's that same level of disdain. And then Todd Haynes is himself bringing that level of influence to the telling of this story. So you'll have early on these long static, not exactly static, but just these unending close-ups of various members of the band that clearly Warhol probably shot at some point or other. on one half of the screen, and then on the other half of the screen, you'll have a mixture of stock footage and you know, footage of the band, whatever, and the voiceover is telling
meticulously constructed.
Oh, absolutely.
Everything that you see on screen is there for a reason.
Yeah.
So, it's the kind of film you want to watch again and again because there's so much visual information taking place. As you said, the screen is almost always split, and often it's more than split. Often it's like six different compartments of stuff that you're supposed to be looking at the same time. It is an immersive visual experience. Yeah.
But like the split screen specifically is very much a shout out to Warhol's Chelsea Girls,
yeah,
which
and,
is a film
Jonas
that was
Mecca's stuff as well.
Yeah. So. But like Chelsea Girls was a film that was designed to be screened on two 16 millimeter projectors.
Yeah.
And because ostensibly there were no specific instructions about when you started the second one,
right,
like no two screenings were ever alike.
Yeah.
And in fact, Mary Warnoff is kind of the star of
right.
Chelsea Girls. But yeah, the people who are still alive who have so much to talk about, the people who aren't around but who did talk about it all before, you know, this movie reminded me that documentaries don't have to be extended news magazine segments,
right,
where
right.
everything happens in order and you get your second voices and, you know, and heaven knows we've seen so many docs lately that are, you know, approved by the subject,
yes.
and that only exists because the subject is like, sure, I'll make this movie and I'll give you access to my back catalog or
right.
my footage or my whatever, but I also have a version of Final Cut where I tell you we could talk about this and we're not talking about that. This, and it's not like there's dirt here to be, you know, uncovered necessarily, but it doesn't feel like this corporate product, this approved infomercial for this performer, that, you know, activist or whatever. It is, like you said, it is in itself a work of art.
Yeah. Okay. Who I loved in this. Lou Reed's sister.
Yes.
Who seems like very cool and in control of like her world and is ready to slice you to ribbons if you denigrate her brother in any way. Like, I just got that feeling from her, and I'm totally into her. And of course, Jonathan Richman.
Yeah, yes.
He's the guy who started the band Modern Lovers. And as a teenager, he was obsessed with the Velvet Underground. Would go see them perform live again and again and again, got to know them. And then eventually formed his own legendary band. He's about 70 now, and as bright-eyed and enthusiastic and happy and excited as you would hope to be at any age, much less 70 or older, and you get this feeling like he's just this bolt of sunshine in the sea of blackness, you know? Every time he was on screen, I was like, oh, good, Jonathan Richman's back. Like, He speaks so lovingly about them and so intelligently that, has he written a book? I know he used to publish like a fanzine about them back in the day, but he could write a book. If he has, and I don't know it exists, then shame on me for being dumb. But
I need to get Mary Warnoff's book that she wrote back in the 90s about, you know, the factory and that whole period, because she's amazing in this.
Uh-huh.
She is a raconteuse. You just want to sit at her feet and hear her tell stories because she's just so, you know, direct and just, you know, she's the kind of person you want to grow up to be.
This film is on Apple Plus.
Yes.
It is also currently in some art house theaters.
Mm-hmm.
It is so, so wonderful. Will there be a film that I love more than this in 2021? I do not know. Maybe. I haven't seen it yet.
This is one that I really wish we could see on the big screen. Because as you said, it is so overloaded.
Well, if you want to go to the new art.
Visual information.
There for a week. But there'll be a big crowd there, I bet.
Yeah.
Yeah. We don't like big crowds.
No. No, thank you.
We don't want to go where big crowds are.
Those
are the films.
Yes. Do you have a DVD pick this week?
I don't.
I'm going to recommend...
I don't have one at all.
Shout Factory, or rather, Scream Factory, has done 4K reissues of the first six, I want to say, Halloween movies.
Okay.
So I'm going to recommend Halloween. The original one. The movie that you can pretty much blame the entire 1980s slasher craze on.
Honestly, thank God for that. Every cheap and terrible and awful slasher movie of the 80s was like a box of chocolates for me.
Okay.
I remember the Siskel and Ebert episode
yes.
where they just went off on those movies. And I was like, but I like them.
And you were writing down titles. Oh, I missed that one. Yeah, my only problem with that was that they couched the whole thing as they called it the Violence Against Women episode.
Right.
It's like, Roger Ebert, you wrote Beyond the Valley of the Dolls.
Yes.
I don't want to hear about it from you. Anyway, so yeah, Halloween 1, 1978, the OG, and you will respect it as such, now out in 4K from Shout Factory. There's a nice new cover with lots of autumn leaves surrounding nice. Michael Myers. Cozy. It's cozy.
It's cozy.
Yeah.
We have letters.
Have we letters?
Jack says, hello again. Jack is the person who has sent us a list of spooky movies.
Yes.
Yeah. Hello again. My partner hated Funny Games.
Well.
And spent 45 minutes yelling F Michael Haneke for trying to make them feel bad about horror movies and implying the viewer's complicity with the killers. My partner wanted me to share with you that our friend's four-year-old refers to Frankenweenie as dead puppy movie.
No. He's not wrong.
My partner made me turn off Santa Sangre due to the gore mixed with how uncomfortable the film made them. They haven't been able to articulate how, because they were fine with Suspiria, Malignant, and the Fear Street trilogy as recent very gory examples. So I am concerned about Audition, Martyrs, Cabin Fever, and My Bloody Valentine.
Oh, my.
If you have recommendations on films similar to those, but less gory, I would appreciate it in case I need to pull a fast-minute switcheroo. I don't know. I love gore, and the worse it is, the more I'm into it.
Yeah, I mean, like, all of my suggestions would be like, what if you watched Robert Wise's The Haunting? You
know? Exactly. I'm the one that got interrogated at a press screening that one time.
Oh, right.
From a couple of older critic friends of ours.
For defending Hostel, right?
For defending Hostel films. And, you know, this was when the torture porn fever was running everywhere.
Yes.
Everybody was like, "Oh, torture porn." And it was the catchphrase of the moment. And one of the critics turned around. They were talking about it.
Yeah.
One of the front critics turned around and said to me, "You like those kind of movies, don't you, Dave?" And I was like, "Yeah." And they said, "Why?"
That's always a great discussion of art.
That's a good question. I said, "Because I like to watch people get their heads chopped off." Go back to reading my book.
I know what I like.
Here's the rest of my list, he says. These are some of my personal favorites that aren't generally considered classics. Trick or Treat, 2007.
Yeah.
Jacob's Ladder, 1990.
Never seen it.
Triangle, 2009. Have not seen Triangle.
Never heard of that one.
The Fly, 1986.
Good stuff.
Cabin Fever, 2002.
Didn't see it.
You didn't? I like it.
Yeah, yeah. Everything about it is like, Eli Roth is not my jam.
Drag Me to Hell, 2009.
Ooh, fun.
Tremors.
I've never seen any of the Tremors.
That first Tremors with Reba McEntire?
No, I know. People love it. Never seen it.
You're Next.
Okay.
Jason Goes to Hell.
Didn't see it.
My Bloody Valentine, 1981.
Mm-hmm.
28 Days Later. Hmm. Yeah.
All right. Happy October, sir.
1981, My Bloody Valentine is just a real, like, it's close to my heart. No, no pun intended, but big fan. Nathan asks, I'm curious if you've seen the Twitter buzz about actor and impersonator Jamie Costa and the faux test screening he created for a potential Robin Williams biopic. I can see why it's getting such buzz, because he does what all impersonations do with a typical manic Williams, but then settles into the man behind the grin. I think it's some truly interesting work. I'm curious what you think about it, but also what the sort of balance you prefer is when it comes to biopics and the accurate embodiment of their famous protagonists. It seems that doing a bad impression sticks out, but also being too faithful can have a similar effect. I've seen cases where accuracy works, Jamie Foxx in Ray, and where it doesn't, Toby Jones in Infamous. Would love to know your thoughts on both the screen test and the actor accuracy in biopics as a whole. Okay, so first thing, I have not watched this clip.
Me neither.
I'll watch it. I'll get back to you about this. I'm reading this letter cold. I'm sorry. I haven't watched it. I know it was a big deal on the internet like 72 hours ago. And I thought, I guess I'll get around to that eventually. But it took me a while to realize that he wasn't actually auditioning for anything. He was just out there
putting it out in the world.
Putting it out in the world, you know, and I admire that hustle. Listen, if you're an actor and you want people to see what you can do, why not put it up on YouTube and get some, you know, well-connected internet friends to be like, hey, check this out. This is my friend. He's doing this thing.
Yeah, I haven't watched it either. It seemed in poor taste.
Why would you consider it to be in poor taste?
I don't know. Just the still of it, seeing him do like this sort of face where he's like, he's kind of mugging, but it's also meant to be like, you know, poignant. I just was like,
oh, I see. No, I haven't watched it, so I don't know what I think about it.
Yes.
But here's what I think about biopics. Stop making them. unless your biopic is the Todd Haynes Bob Dylan movie.
Well, that's an extreme way to go.
Or about someone that I don't know anything about, that I've never heard of, but this is a fascinating person. You know, if your subject is interesting for some reason that I need to learn about, great.
Well, okay, but I think that the problem is we get so many biopics
most of them are awful.
And most of them are awful in the way that most of anything is awful.
All right.
But I think that I believe me, after seeing so many of them, I would be happy to dismiss them all out of hand. But then every so often,
I'm going to keep doing that.
You get like you get Renee Zellweger's performance in Judy, which is genuinely great and pays homage to someone who you'd think
she is very good.
The movie's okay.
The movie's fine.
She's great, yeah, though. Sure, okay. You know, I think Behind the Candelabra, I always come back to that one. I think it's a really great biopic, yeah. And I think Michael Douglas kind of disappears into the role.
Yeah.
I do think that if you're going to play somebody who is recognizable,
yeah,
then you have to try and capture them as well as possible and try and disappear into it, frankly. You know, we just not that many weeks ago, we talked about Eyes of Tammy Faye.
Yes.
And that if Jessica Chastain had gone full bore into sounding what Tammy Faye sounded like on a regular basis,
right,
on television anyway,
right,
that audiences might have found that off-putting.
Right.
But if you do know what Tammy Faye talked like, and then you watch Jessica Chastain's approximation, it's like, well, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
You know, either go big or go home, you know, and you know, it's that Lorenzo's Oil conundrum, you know, where people, yeah, thought Nick Nolte was doing like some crazy overdone accent. And then you hear the guy he's playing, he's like, nope, that's how he spoke English.
Right.
So, yeah, I kind of feel like it is a bit of a damned if you do, damned if you don't. But if you're going to be the kind of actor who steps up and be like, I'm going to play this person that you know, and not even a thing where like, you know, there's the argument like Faye Dunaway isn't really playing Joan Crawford. She's playing Joan Crawford characters. She's playing the movie version of Joan Crawford.
She's playing the Joan Crawford that Christina Crawford wrote about in that book.
Right. But the actual performance.
I understand what you're saying.
You know,
yes.
She's giving you, oh, look, it's Harriet Craig. Oh, look, it's Straightjacket, whatever.
Right.
You know, but I think, you know, they're like this guy playing Robin Williams. Is he playing Mork? You know, or is he playing like Robin Williams on The Tonight Show? Or is he playing like maybe a Robin Williams that we've never seen before? And then if he is, like, do audiences go, well, who's that guy? You know, and right. So that's a conundrum you get stuck in with biopics. But yeah, most biopics are terrible and they're generally a waste of time. But every so often, every rare so often, somebody gets it right.
Yeah, it's the impersonation aspect that starts me down the road of, when will this be over?
Well, like, I haven't seen Infamous. I did see Capote, and I thought Philip Seymour Hoffman was great in that.
Yeah.
How is Hoffman's Capote different from Jones's Capote?
I've seen them both, and I cannot remember.
Okay. Because Hoffman is, like, physically all wrong. He's twice as tall as Capote was, you know.
Right.
But he makes it work.
We're done.
Oh, okay.
This is the end of the podcast.
This is the end of the podcast.
Yeah.
All right. Well, listen, thanks everybody for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. I have lost track of what podcasts I've talked about.
Who are our friends
on
the internet?
In depth and detail.
Anymore.
We have so many of them. Here's one I haven't talked about in a while.
Yeah.
Sam Pancake presents the Monday Afternoon Movie.
He's got a good one this week.
Oh, man.
His guest is Lorraine Newman.
Yes.
And they are talking about, what's the movie?
I don't even remember. It's something within...
Barbara Eden is
pregnant with an alien baby.
An alien baby, yeah.
It's
basically Titan.
Kind of.
But from the 70s.
Yeah.
And done terribly.
Exactly. Titan, but with Joyce Van Patten as the next door neighbor. Anyway, always a funny show. His guests are terrific, even when it's you or me. But, you know, it's just a wonder.
My episode was real good.
It was. You all talked about Duel. I was on talking about some, like, you know, Monster on an Airplane movie that was fun. But anyway, always, like, you know, strum through the list and see, like, oh, I know this movie or I've heard of this movie. Or just pick one at random or just start with the new one and go backwards. But you can't go wrong. It's always a lot of fun. So, yeah, Sam Pancake presents the Monday Afternoon Movie.
Yeah.
You can subscribe to this program at Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, leave us a 5-star review. We will read it on the show.
Yeah.
You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Spotify, Google Play, Apple Music, the lounge.com, you know, that one, Stitcher, and all kinds of other places. Thank you, Blue, for our wonderful theme music. Check out his wonderful work at blueBLEU.bandcamp.com. Follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And again, my new book, written in collaboration with the Deck the Hallmark podcast, I'll Be Home for Christmas Movies, is out Tuesday, October 26th. Pre-order it now wherever you get books, be it online, be it at your local indie brick and mortar store. Just get it. Until next time.
Oh, you know what else you forgot to say?
What?
We do other podcasts.
Oh, good heavens.
And you can subscribe to them.
At Patreon.
Patreon.com/linoleumknife. There are a variety of them for you to enjoy, and depending on the level of subscription, you get them. That's all.
Yeah.
And now,
patreon.com/linoleumknife. Until next time.
Goodbye.